Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sam Pizzigatti, veteran labor journalist and author, who discusses why candidates from both major political parties largely avoid a debate on rising U.S. economic inequality during the 2014 election campaign. Karthik Ganapathy of the climate change group 350.org, who talks about the results of the midterm election and the coming showdown between Congress and the White House over the Keystone XL pipeline. And Sean Glenn, a young climate activist, who explains her motivation for participating in the 8-month-long cross-country Great March for Climate Action and her decision to risk arrest by engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As the November 24th deadline approaches for a nuclear deal between the West and Iran, Russia has emerged as a key player. Moscow is working on a plan with Tehran's leaders to convert uranium into fuel for Iran's civilian nuclear reactor. Western powers negotiating with Iran, dubbed the P5 plus one, include the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia. Once uranium is converted into fuel rods, it's extremely difficult for it to be used in building nuclear weapons. Media reports say the United States and European Union are open to further negotiations on the contentious issue of the number of centrifuges for enriching uranium that Iran will be allowed to keep in a future nuclear agreement. However, the Republican Party takeover of the U.S. Senate and the ascendancy of the hawkish wing of the GOP is fueling calls for new economic sanctions against Iran, increasing pressure on the Obama administration to reach a deal with Iran before year's end. Traveling in Europe prior to a new round of negotiations with Iranian officials, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry declared, "We are driving toward the finish with the view of getting this done." The outcome of the nuclear negotiations relies to a great extent on the political space in Iran given to pragmatists surrounding President Hassan Rouhani. Meanwhile, hardliners in Tehran's powerful clerical hierarchy have ruled out future formal diplomatic ties with the United States. A new peer-reviewed health study has identified and measured toxic air pollution near oil and gas drilling wells in states heavily impacted by the controversial hydraulic fracturing or fracking extraction method, which has boosted U.S. oil and gas production. The study examined air pollution levels in Colorado, Arkansas, Ohio, Wyoming, and Pennsylvania. Published in the scientific journal Environmental Health, the study found that 40% of its air samples exceeded federal standards on toxic compounds and chemical mixtures such as benzene and formaldehyde that increase the risk of cancer. The energy industry immediately attacked the study for its recruitment of citizen activists to collect air samples. They specifically singled out Global Community Monitor, a group that trained volunteers to take air samples. A related study from Yale University found that residents in Pennsylvania who live within 2 miles of natural gas wells were much more likely to report skin rashes and upper respiratory problems than residents who reside farther away from fracking wells. The National Institutes of Health are currently supporting 9 studies on the link between asthma and natural gas fracking. Weeks after a mass school shooting in suburban Seattle, voters in Washington state overwhelmingly approved a ballot initiative to extend background checks to all gun transfers, including sales at gun shows. At the same time, voters rejected a measure supported by pro-gun groups that would have limited background checks. The campaign showcased a new strategy developed by gun control activists to bypass Congress and reluctant state capitals and take common-sense gun regulation directly to the voters. The Washington State Initiative, I-594, was funded with a $10 million budget, including $3 million contributed by billionaire and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's gun control group, Every Town for Gun Safety. The day after the gun control ballot victory, Sandy Brown of the Center for Gun Responsibility called the 60% majority that voted for gun background checks a beginning of a permanent movement to reduce the plague of gun violence in Washington state. Pro-gun control state legislators plan to reintroduce a bill to make it a crime to leave a loaded gun where a child can access it. Washington has become the fifth state to pass universal background checks since the massacre at Newtown, Connecticut's Sandy Hook Elementary School 2 years ago. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The results of the 2014 midterm election were decidedly bad news for Democratic Party candidates from coast to coast. Republicans took control of the U.S. Senate, gaining at least 7 seats, expanded their majority in the House of Representatives by 12 seats, and won more governor's mansions and state legislatures. The few bright spots for progressive activists were seen in statewide and local referendums. Voters in Alaska, Arkansas, Illinois, Nebraska, and South Dakota all approved ballot questions boosting the minimum wage. Colorado and North Dakota defeated so-called personhood measures restricting reproductive rights. Colorado and Oregon voters approved ballot questions mandating the labeling of GMO foods. And in a continuing national trend, Alaska, Oregon, and Washington, D.C. favored legalizing marijuana. And proposed measures banning natural gas fracking won 8 ballots at the city and county level. Pundits and political operatives pointed to a number of factors present in the 2014 election that helped explain the dismal showing of Democrats. Primary among them was the lowest voter turnout in more than 70 years, with only 36.4% of eligible voters going to the polls. Also on that list was the historic poor showing for the party in power at the White House and the record-breaking flood of unlimited and unaccountable corporate money spent on election campaigns this year, a direct result of the Supreme Court's Citizens United and McCutcheon rulings. Then there were new voter suppression laws enforced in almost 24 GOP-controlled states, making it more difficult for millions of Democratic-leaning voters to cast ballots. But while the buckets of covert corporate cash and new obstacles confronting voters certainly played a role, Sam Pizzagatti, a veteran labor journalist and Institute for Policy Studies Associate Fellow, says that one reason that the vast majority of voters failed to participate in 2014 was that candidates from both parties largely failed to address one of the most important issues facing American families, growing income inequality. Your reporter spoke with Sam Pizzagatti, who explains why he believes both major parties avoid discussion of this critical economic issue.
Back in 1982, the richest 0.01% of America, that's people who today are making over $20 million a year. But back in 1982, this small 0.01% of America, the richest 0.01%, accounted for less than 10% of all federal political campaign contributions. And in the 2012 elections, they accounted for over 40%. And in this last week's election, I'm sure the figure is even higher. We don't have the final statistic on that yet. So in other words, the share of the campaign contributions that's come from the super rich has more than quadrupled over the past 30 years. And so I don't think it should be any surprise why we have the sorts of politics that we do.
Sam, review for our listeners, if you would, some of the statistics that come out of credible sources that speak to rising economic inequality in the United States, and certainly in comparison to many other countries around the world.
Well, let's start with one of those comparisons to another country. Let's look at France, which is a developed nation. And if you add up all the wealth in France, and you divide it by the number of adults, and you do the same thing in the United States, you get figures that are very close. So in France, the average wealth per adult, and again, we're taking the total wealth and dividing it by the number of adults. In France, that comes to $317,000 of wealth per adult. In the United States, it's a little bit more. It's $348,000 of wealth per adult. But that figure in the United States is incredibly distorted by the amount of wealth at the top. So if you look instead of average wealth, if you look at median wealth, and remember, median wealth means if you take everybody, all the adults, and you look for the point in that distribution where half the adults make more and the other half make less. That's the median household wealth. In other words, that's the wealth of the typical person. In France, the wealth of the typical person last year was $141,000. In the United States, the wealth of the typical person was $53,000 per person. In other words, almost $90,000 less. And you can look at that $90,000 difference between the median and the average household wealth as our inequality penalty. That's the penalty that we as Americans suffer for living in a country where wealth has concentrated at the top. In other words, we have a total wealth comparable to France, but their wealth is much more equally divided than our wealth.
Would you review for our listeners some of the prescriptions to reverse our rising economic inequality in this country? What are the policies that you would say are basic to really addressing and reversing economic inequality?
Well, there are some old staples. The tax system, of course, is a prime weapon. So I think we need to make our tax system much more progressive than it is. We need to raise rates on our very highest incomes. We need to move back to the rates that we had back in the 1950s under President Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was, as you may remember, a Republican, but a Republican concerned about inequality. So taxes is one major area. But I think we also need to do something about what people working on inequality in Britain call pre-distribution. That is how the market distributes rewards for the work we do, and right now those rewards for the work Americans are doing are getting snared by a very small group of executives, people at the top of our corporations.
Given the fact that President Obama in the past has identified economic inequality as one of the major issues confronting this country, it is a bit mysterious why he nor many of his candidates around the country who are, you know, running for the House or Senate engaged in a discussion of these issues that may well have garnered them more votes, more interest, and more turnout at the polls on November 4th.
And in fact, Scott, the exit polls that were done on Election Day last week, in those election exit polls, 64% of people who came out to vote last Tuesday said they believe America's economy favors the wealthy. That was the question, does it favor the wealthy or not? 64% said the economy favors the wealthy. So clearly there's a huge public sentiment out there that wants to see candidates take on the concentration of income and wealth in the United States. And as you just noted, the candidates didn't do that. And again, I think the major reason for that is that Democratic candidates tried to get their votes from average working people, but they get their money for their campaigns, the bulk of their money, from people at the top of our economy. And for those people, they don't want their candidates talking about issues around the distribution of income and wealth.
That was Sam Pizzagatti, an associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book, The Rich Don't Always Win. Find links to Pizzagatti's weekly newsletter, Too Much, and more analysis of economic inequality in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. It's a sad irony that less than 2 months after the world's largest protest confronting climate change in New York City on September 21st, the U.S. midterm election conferred all political power in the U.S. Congress to the Republican Party, which largely dismisses the science behind the assertion that climate change is a dire threat to the planet. Perhaps the most determined foe of climate change policy in Washington is Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe, the likely next chair of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Inhofe, a proud climate science denier, has often stated that global warming is a hoax and believes that a warmer planet may have a beneficial effect on our lives. Come January, with Republicans in control of both houses of Congress, All that stands between a dramatic rollback of many existing environmental policies in the trash can is President Obama's veto pen. Top Republican priorities include targeting Environmental Protection Agency rules, limiting carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants, dismantling or weakening the Federal Clean Water Act, expediting approval of liquefied natural gas exports, and ending the decades-old ban on crude oil exports. But perhaps the most important and symbolic environmental policy issue up for debate next year is the decision facing the White House on the future of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline that would carry 900,000 barrels of dirty tar sands oil each day from Alberta, Canada to the Gulf Coast. President Obama has said that he will only allow the pipeline to be built if it doesn't significantly worsen carbon pollution. And although a State Department review of the project concluded the pipeline won't increase carbon emissions, environmental groups assert that the study was deeply flawed and that tar sands oil and its extraction produce more greenhouse gas emissions than natural gas and traditional crude oil. Your reporter spoke with Karthik Ganapathy, U.S. Communications Manager with the climate change group 350.org, who discusses the results of the midterm election and the coming showdown over the Keystone XL pipeline.
The electorate that votes in a midterm election in a year with an unpopular president, you know, that's generally going to favor the opposition party. So I don't think it surprised anyone that the Republicans did well on Tuesday. But I think it would be a mistake to fixate on the sort of we're doomed, you know, kind of coverage that we've been seeing everywhere. Yes, Jim Inhofe is going to be the new chairman of the Environment Committee. And yes, he wrote a book denying that global warming is real. But I think, you know, time and again, the environmental movement has been written off as something that has no power, that can't actually get anything done. And I think that's largely been a mistake. Every time that the D.C. Beltway has sort of written us off and said Keystone's going to get built no matter what, Keystone's going to get built. No, this time for real, Keystone's going to get built. I think every time grassroots supporters have sort of mobilized to stop that and to show that voters in this country really do care about climate change.
In talking about the Keystone XL pipeline, it seems that it's in the crosshairs of the new Republican majority in the Senate, where you have a lot of politicians in post-election interviews talking about getting the Keystone XL pipeline going and under construction is one of the top priorities. What is your view of President Obama and where he's going with this? He put off the decision until after this election. But certainly he's not in any kind of stronger position here when it comes to Congress to stop it if that's what he wants to do.
I think ultimately this is the president's call. I think a lot of the coverage that we've been seeing has sort of fixated on the idea that now that Republicans have both houses of Congress, that the Keystone's a done deal, that, you know, even suggesting that it doesn't have a chance of passing is, you know, ludicrous. And I think that's mistaken. And that's because at the end of the day, this is the president's decision. And you're right that we've sort of kicked the can down the road in sort of in terms of making a decision. But when President Obama outlined his Keystone principle, you know, he laid out a clear litmus test. And that's that if Keystone harms the environment or accelerates development of tar sands to the point where it will cause significant damage to the environment, that's not something that the State Department can sign off on. And so I think at the end of the day, though, the president has all the information he needs to reject the pipeline. And for our part, we're going to keep putting pressure on the president and on congressional leaders to do the right thing here. For the president, this is the last 2 years of his presidency. He doesn't have to worry about politics anymore. He doesn't have to worry about which voters are going to turn up at the polls. Well, what he has to do is what's right for him and for his legacy. And he's made some progress on climate, well, more than any other president before him, I would argue. And so I think for him to approve Keystone would be a huge oil splotch, I think, on what otherwise could be seen as a pretty good climate record.
One of the concerns I know of many climate change activists and environmentalists is that President Obama, confronted by the new reality of the Republican-controlled Senate, might trade away the Keystone XL pipeline for some measures that might be positive in another area in terms of maybe Congress laying off an attack on new EPA regulations on carbon emissions from coal plants, for instance. Do you think some kind of bargain might be in the making where Keystone could be traded away in favor of some other policy gain?
You know, I really hope not. You're certainly not the first one to speculate that, and that could be possible. But I think at the end of the day, I really think this comes down to the president's legacy. And I think it would be a mistake for him to sort of bargain. I think a lot of people would say that a defining feature of the Obama presidency has been to start negotiating and in a position that's far too centrist to begin with. So you end up with a compromise measure that's really more of a Republican bill and then still get the right opposed to it just on principle because it's something that the president supported. I think it's fair to say that that's been a recurring theme in the Obama presidency. And so I think for him to negotiate too much in terms of let's protect this section of the EPA regulations if we approve Keystone, I think that's a mistake. And not least because Keystone is disastrous policy. The much touted job creation, the benefits, the economic benefits that the Republicans claim will come from Keystone. Numerous analyses have shown that a lot of the jobs are temporary jobs that will happen in constructing the pipeline, and that the permanent jobs created could be as few as 20. That's less than a shopping mall. I think it would be a disastrous mistake to approve that on any sort of economic benefit while ignoring the massive impact that it would have on the environment. Tar sands, as I'm sure you know, is one of the oiliest, dirtiest extraction methods there is. And so signing off on that would be a huge mistake. But I think at the end of the day, what you're going to see is an event or a series of events between now and January that send a message that Keystone is linked fundamentally to the climate deniers who say that global warming is a myth.
That was Karthik Ganapathy, U.S. Communications Manager with the climate change group 350.org. For more analysis and commentary on climate change and U.S. politics, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The first week of November saw daily nonviolent civil disobedience actions at the offices of FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in Washington, D.C. The protest was organized by a group called Beyond Extreme Energy. Activists from the shale fields of Pennsylvania joined dozens of supporters in an effort to block entrances to the building to protest FERC's approval of almost all the natural gas infrastructure proposals that come before it. In evaluating the projects, the commission doesn't consider the source of the energy, so the fact that the natural gas is produced by the fracking extraction method, with its attendant environmental and health impacts, is not a factor in FERC's decisions, nor is the role natural gas plays in exacerbating climate change. Environmental critics charge that far from being a bridge to a clean energy future, the construction of natural gas pipelines, compressor stations, and export terminals is locking in the use of fossil fuels for decades to come. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who participated in the week of actions, spoke with Sean Glenn, a young woman who walked across the country with a Great March for Climate Action from March 1st to November 1st when the group and its many supporters walked the last 7 miles to the White House for a rally. The stated goal of the Great March for Climate Action was to change the hearts and minds of the American people, elected leaders, and people across the world to act now to address the climate crisis. Here Glenn explains her motivation for getting involved in the march, why she walked the first 3 months in silence, and her decision to be arrested twice in 3 days by engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience in Washington, D.C.
I decided to do it for many reasons, to stand in solidarity with the unheard victims of climate change, which I was feeling like one of those, the plants, animals, people living in islands all over the place. I mean, everyone really at this point, because it's climate change is a global issue, and no one's really listening to that. And it was also, I wasn't ready to just fight my way across the country just screaming about climate change and all the terrible things that are happening, because I was in school and I was just terribly depressed with the state of the world and the fact that no one was really listening or ready to do anything about it. So those were like the main two reasons, I think, for me. And also just that, like, we talk about stuff like this so much, and what are those words actually doing? To a certain extent, it's time to just like really make a change rather than just keep talking about it over and over and over again. But yeah, and it was really a time of finding more peace within myself and a really great healing moment for myself. And it was time to step back from my own story and to let other people kind of build my story a little bit. And they just really helped me to build this really happy, loving, peaceful, ready to go person, and I'm entirely humbled and grateful for the community for supporting me in my decision to do that, and so happy that they decided to help me carry it throughout the country when I decided it was time to speak.
So skipping ahead 8 months, the march finished, well, marched in from Bethesda to the White House, which was actually a mere 7 miles, because I know you did you did some days that were three times that long, but and a lot of people joined you, including myself. That was my one and only day on the march. What was it like for you to finish the march and come to finish in D.C.?
It was an awesome day, our last day into the D.C. This has been our life for 8 months. But it was beautiful, and I was just so ready to be there with everybody. And I know everyone was just tired, too. So I think it was time for the march to come to an end. And it was time for everybody to move on to the next step. It's been a huge growing experience and learning experience as far as what we think will really work in this movement and what we feel we really need to do as individuals in this movement. So yeah, coming into DC, it was really, really beautiful. I'm just so grateful I was given this opportunity and so happy I took it.
So, Sean Glenn, you were one of 11 people who were arrested on November 4th after getting on Dominion Resources property near Cove Point, Maryland, where the company got permission from FERC to build an enormous liquid natural gas export terminal. If that goes online, it would vastly increase the amount of gas that's fracked in the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania and nearby states. Local opponents of the project and other supporters saw the six of you scale a big dirt pile and hold up a sign saying, "We are greater than Dominion profits." Then three of you from that action got arrested with two others a few days later in front of FERC.
Well, it just seems like this is where we're at in this movement right now. We really need people putting themselves on the line, willing to serve time or pay money or do whatever we got to do to like stop these projects, whether it's in an office signing on a yes to a construction zone or going to the construction and actually halting the whole progress and the whole destruction of the land there and the communities and everything. And it's in marching across the country, that's the one thing that I learned I was very ready to do. I have done marches before, I've participated in rallies my whole life long, and I've been knocking on doors and filling out petitions and all that, and it's all good work. It's definitely good work, but I was just so ready to just like see something stop right in front of me for my own being there. And it really is just something I can't wait to do more of. And it's just an opportunity to really use this physical body that we're given to do some really good work and to actually slow things down.
That was Sean Glenn, who participated in the 8-month-long Great March for Climate Action across the U.S. and then took part in a week of protest actions in opposition to natural gas fracking. For more information on the FERC protests and related issues, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.